Observers say the best way to lead the nation to a real national unity is to remove the obstacles in the way of the ongoing peace talks between the government and Taliban in the Qatari capital Doha. Sayed Amin Olami, Kabul.
A shutdown is being observed in Indian-controlled Kashmir after New Delhi amended and repealed a series of decades-old land laws of Kashmir. The new reorganization law issued on October 26, 2020, opens up all of Jammu and Kashmir to every Indian citizen and removes every restriction that prevented large land holdings. Allows the Indian Armed Forces to take over land wherever they desire and gives sweeping powers to the government to take over any land and property for industrial use and bring in big businesses to set up their shops. People's Democratic Party President Mehbooba Mufti, while criticizing the government's move, accused India of land grab for big investors. The October 26, 2020 order repealed 13 state laws and amends 14 laws. Experts say this is to further the agenda behind the abrogation. According to historic date check, these laws were introduced to empower the majority Muslims who were suffering immensely under the non-Muslim rulers. Not only this, but the rights to buy and sell land in Kashmir were also confined to the people of Kashmir. Experts say India's move in Kashmir since August 5, 2019 has further internationalized this conflict. In response to the shutdown call by Pro-Freedom Camp of Kashmir, shops and businesses remained closed. Huge number of government forces were seen guarding the streets to avoid law and order problems. Almost seven decades ago, these laws were introduced to empower the Muslim majority of Kashmir. But today, when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is repealing and amending the same laws, the people of Kashmir are watching over helplessly. Experts say this move clearly depicts India's intentions in Kashmir. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The U.S. economy just recorded its largest quarter of economic growth ever, 33%. Too bad it comes on the heels of a 31% plunge in the last economic quarter. The seven-month-long failure to pass a second stimulus package pushed stocks to their worst week in 7 months. The U.S. appears to have been taken by surprise by the long-expected autumn wave of coronavirus, with new lockdowns creating major anger among the businesses who weren't bankrupted by the spring lockdowns.
The small manufacturing businesses, even small service businesses, we need to assume their expenses so that when we're on the other side of the pandemic, they're still viable. There isn't a will to do that, and I think that's because the government's really controlled by the major corporations and major banks, and they don't want it.
Pro-Trump media coverage is dominated by the ever-ballooning allegations of major financial corruption by the Biden family. Joe Biden has never disputed the authenticity of the proof which alleges corruption, but he has denied the allegations of corruption. Anti-Trump media is focused on widespread fears of post-election violence.
I tend to think we're going to get through the election okay, you know? But there are enough crazy people out there, and it's been promoted. That type of hatred has been promoted, by Trump. It's been promoted by television stations.
Right-wing media says the polls show that Donald Trump might lose the general election but will handily win the Electoral College vote. Their claim is based around the so-called shy voter theory that Trump supporters aren't talking honestly to polling agencies. Centrist media says the majority of polls maintain a small but narrowing lead for the challenger Joe Biden. They say Biden will win handily when the record number of mail-in ballots are totally counted, which could take many weeks. Add all that up and throw in a few more vital issues which we don't have the space to list, and it's clear that America is heading into a historic election in a hugely chaotic state marked by fear, uncertainty, and hysteria. The vote is on Tuesday, November 3rd. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
More protests were held in the Italian capital on Saturday over the government's decision to impose tougher measures to contain the spread of the pandemic. Early in the afternoon, hundreds of far-right demonstrators staged a rally in Campo di Fiori against a new decree which has ordered the closure of gyms, cinemas and theatres, requiring cafes and restaurants to close their doors at 6 p.m. Clashes with police were recorded during the demonstration. Later on Saturday, another protest was held in Independence Square, not far from Rome's central train station, where thousands of protesters vented their anger at the latest anti-COVID-19 restrictions. This demonstration, dubbed You Close Us, You Pay, was called by a coalition of social movements and base unions.
Unfortunately, the government has done nothing to reduce the flow of travelers on local public transports, which have been turned into hotbeds of COVID-19 transmission. Furthermore, too many workers have not received any payroll subsidies from the government yet. How can they pay their bills and mortgage installments?
The government cannot close cafes and restaurants at 6 p.m. Owners can scrape by, maybe. But what about us workers? These restrictions are killing us.
From north to south, Italy's been hit by a wave of protests, some violent, following the introduction of more stringent coronavirus shutdown measures by the government. The country's interior ministry has warned that these demonstrations have been infiltrated by subversives who are trying to stir up trouble.
As the contagion curve continues to rise in Italy, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte insists he doesn't want to enforce another lockdown, but many fear a new national quarantine is becoming inevitable.
So many people have already closed their activity after the first lockdown. Some managed to survive, but they won't survive a second lockdown.
The government is expected to present a decree including new restrictions as early as Monday. Targeted lockdowns and restrictions of movement between regions are among the new measures reportedly being discussed. Max Civili, Rome.
Violent clashes in Pakistani capital Islamabad. Police use heavy shelling to prevent thousands of angry protesters to march towards the French embassy in the capital. Protesters reached near the red zone after they forcibly removed heavy security barriers one after the other on the road leading towards the diplomatic enclave. At the heart of public anger is frequent incidents of blasphemy committed against the Prophet of Islam. Many protesters were injured in the violent clashes with the police. Over a dozen were also arrested.
This is just tip of the iceberg of a public anger against France. Protesters are saying that they are not going to settle down anything short of shutting down French embassy and expelling French ambassador from Islamabad.
French newspapers have repeatedly published blasphemous cartoons under the cover of freedom of speech. However, for Muslims in Pakistan and elsewhere, it was a politically motivated attempt to insult Islam, which, according to a Pew survey, is spreading across Europe. The official patronage to the blasphemers by the French government have added fuel to fire in Pakistan, like elsewhere in the Muslim world.
If someone speaks against the dignity and honor of Rasulullah alayhi salatu wasalam, then we will say, my mother, my father, my children, each and every one of them, I am ready to sacrifice them on the dignity and honor of Rasulullah alayhi salatu wasalam. Now we are not going to tolerate it anymore, until and unless the ambassador of France would have been kicked out from Pakistan, we will be here, inshallah ta'ala.
When you abuse of Prophet, when you insult him, nauzubillah, and then when you keep doing it again and again, then we'll definitely respond. Everybody in this world will respond if you keep hurting their sentiments.
In retaliation to controversial remarks of French president against Islam, protesters insulted his images. Anti-France sentiments have surged suddenly at an unprecedented level after repeated incidents of blasphemy of Islam. Similar protests were also held across Pakistan. Like elsewhere in the Muslim world, people have started boycotting French products in Pakistan. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that France under President Macron is encouraging Islamophobia, which is creating further polarization and marginalization of Muslims in the West, that he believes would inevitably lead towards radicalization in the world. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The birthday of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history.
We can liken the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, to the brightest star in the universe. Why do I say he is like a bright star? Not the sun. It is because the sun is a definite celestial body. It is bright and magnificent, but it is a celestial body. However, among the stars that you see, there are some which are galaxies and are thousands of times larger than the one we see in summer nights. A galaxy is a collection of thousands of solar systems and suns. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, was like a galaxy, and he had thousands of virtues which shone brightly like a star.
You are my one true love, taught me to never judge. Now all I want is to be with you. على حبيبك نبيك مصطفى اللهم صل على سيدنا مصطفى على حبيبك نبيك مصطفى
In him, knowledge is accompanied by morality. Government is accompanied by wisdom. Worshipping God is accompanied by serving people. Jihad is accompanied by mercy. Love of God is accompanied by love of His creatures. Pride is accompanied by modesty. Being up to date is accompanied by foresight. Honesty is accompanied by complexity. In political matters, attention to God is accompanied by attention to peace and health. Attention to worldly matters is accompanied by attention to spiritual matters. And pursuing divine goals is accompanied by pursuing human goals. He is a perfect example of a human being, and God Almighty has not created a person who is as perfect as him. He is a bearer of good news, and he is a warner. He knows what all humanity is doing, and he knows everything that happens in history. He is the person who invites all humanity to get close to God, and he is a shining beacon of guidance for humanity.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Debate. I'm your host, Beher Usnajafi. Sudanese people have held a rally in protest against a joint statement from Israel, Sudan, and the U.S. regarding working toward a normalization agreement with Tel Aviv. Political parties have rejected the decision and promised to form an opposition front against it. The news was announced after Washington removed Sudan from its terror list and offered it access to billions of dollars of desperately needed financial assistance. This, of course, after Sudan agreed to pay $335 million in compensation to the victims of al-Qaeda bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. Stay with us for a debate of the issue.
Sudan agreed on Friday to take steps to normalize ties with Israel in a deal brokered by the United States. President Donald Trump sealed the agreement in a phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and Transitional Council head Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The normalization drew strong criticism from Palestinians who have already expressed opposition to similar deals by the UAE and Bahrain. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the agreement as a violation of UN Security Council and Arab League resolutions. The resistance movement Hamas slammed the deal as a political sin, while the Palestinian Islamic Jihad called the move a betrayal of the Palestinian people and their cause. Separately, Abbas Fatah movement also denounced the deal.
We totally denouncing this deal, and we are sure that the Sudanese people, intellectuals, Sudanese national parties, the people of Sudan also will reject this deal.
Sudan's agreement also sparked strong criticism at home, with several political parties warning that they would form a national front against the Israel deal. Khartoum's decision had already stirred up anti-Israel sentiments in the country, where protesters set fire to the regime's flag. Sudanese say the deal is not in favor of their country.
Against normalization, because normalization does not serve the interests of Sudan, neither now nor tomorrow.
Sudan agreed to normalize its relations with Israel after the U.S. president announced about removing the African nation from its so-called list of state sponsors of terrorism. Trump tweeted that Khartoum had agreed to pay $335 million in compensation to victims and families of the 1998 attacks on American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Sudan is the third Arab nation to agree to recognize Israel after the UAE and Bahrain signed similar deals with the regime last month. Trump even seeks more normalization agreements with other Arab states, including Saudi Arabia. But questions arise as why those accords reached just ahead of the November presidential election in the U.S., the reason being Trump himself, who is trailing behind his Democratic rival Joe Biden in opinion polls, with his re-election bid affected by plenty of domestic and foreign issues. While Trump's image remains questionable at home, the normalization deals are seen as his last-ditch effort to boost support in order to secure a second term in office.
Joining me in this debate show will be Professor of Political Science with Birzeit University, Saad An-Nimr from Ramallah, and political activist Ali Al-Faraji joining us from Birmingham. Good to have you on the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Ramallah first. Professor An-Nimr, some observers argue that Sudan has been pressurized into accepting to work towards signing this deal with Israel. And some others believe that the country has been blackmailed. How do you look at it?
As a matter of fact, as you said, it's not just pressurized. They were blackmailed quite obviously. They were blackmailed, not only with the $335 million that they had to pay to the victims, as they call between brackets, to the victims in America of Al-Qaeda doing in 1988, but also to take their name off the American records of terrorism. They needed to do anything because they were looking forward for, you know, some agreement with the World Bank to have some loans, and they can't do that as far as they are in the terrorist list by the Americans. So they were blackmailed, but apparently the American conditions were not only the $335 million, which, by the way, paid by Emirates to the Saudis, to the Sudanese, to pay it to the Americans. But also, the other condition was to recognize Israel and to normalize the relationship. And the Americans were pressurizing Sudan just 10 days before the elections started in the United States, and less than 2 weeks for Trump try to achieve something for his own election. So it's a quite clear situation of blackmailing Sudan and try to pressurize Sudan in order to take off their name from the terrorist list and to just get them the aid which they desperately needed after a while, the bad situation economically. So they were under this pressure by the Americans to normalize with Israel.
Now let me turn to Birmingham, to Ali Al-Faraj. Ali, Sudan has no parliament and elections are due in 2 years' time. Does this not question the authority of the administration to make such a decision?
Of course, there is a legislative vacuum in Sudan, as the transitional government in Sudan is run by the military, and they have no right to do such big deals. In fact, there is the pressure from the United States and from the Trump government has been made in a rush because of the American election. It has nothing to do with the Sudanese interest. There is a clear opposition from people of Sudan. We've seen hundreds of thousands of people protesting in Khartoum, only the capital, and the opposition, the political parties in Sudan are against this deal. So there is no ground for such deal at all. In fact, the Sudan itself, as a country, big country, will not benefit much from such deal. So there is no backup or legal part of the deal. In fact, the Sudanese themselves, they don't know what is this deal about. It's just done so that there will be normal relationship between Sudan and Zionist regime, without the Sudanese actually getting much. 300 million is nothing in comparing it to a country like Sudan. I mean, looking into the history, the United States has put Sudan under an embargo for several decades, in which Sudan lost billions of dollars, not $300 million. So, maybe the only people who would benefit in Sudan are some of the military leaders because of the history of being put under the terrorist list, in the American terrorist list. And these are the people who would benefit, but probably because they don't want to lose their popularity in Sudan by agreeing directly, and this is the reason why there is some hesitancy in the Sudanese government and their announcements.
Now, Professor Nem, leader of the Popular Congress Party, Kamal Omar, argues that Sudan's transitional government is not elected, so it's not authorized to normalize relations with Israel. We also have former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi slamming this decision and saying that this is in contravention of the Sudanese national law. Your comment, please.
The formation of this government came after the revolution happened in Sudan in the last year, which came to an agreement that it will be between the military on the one hand and the civilians on the other hand, and after 2 years there will be an exchange and the civilian will take over and they will restore democracy and restore civil administration generally in Sudan. But till now there isn't any real thing happening, because this formation already came by an agreement, not by the elections. So far they don't have a parliament in Sudan, mm-hmm. and the formation of the government so far, it came by only the parties which participated in the revolution the last year and a half, which they pressurized to finish the previous government and to bring in the military and the civil government together in this formation. But it is not backed by parliament, because they're supposed to have an elections, but the military again they postpone, because they are now having their term of 2 years running the country. So the country now mm-hmm. is run by the military generally, not by the civilians, and that's why they postpone the elections for a parliament, which would make things more real. So because of that, there is a huge rejection in Sudan, and the demonstrations today and the burning of the so-called the place where supposed to have the Israeli embassy, mm-hmm. The building, it was burned today, and the people of Sudan is expressing their rejection, their real rejection to any move towards the Israeli normalization, because they know by the end of the day, first of all, they are not going to gain anything of this game, and secondly, they are not going to let down the Arab people as well as the Palestinian people and normalize with the enemy of the Arab entity in general, just because of the American pressure and because of the American to please the American rather. So because mm-hmm. of that, we think that yes, the decision is not from the legal perspective is not correct, and they have to go back to the people to take such an agreement into reality. So because of the objection of most of the parties and the people, it shouldn't go ahead. And if they sign it, there will be lots of problems in Sudan.
Now, Ali Al-Faraj, in addition to the people that Professor Nem also mentioned, major political parties in Sudan have opposed the deal with Tel Aviv, and they have promised to form an opposition front. What do you expect could happen?
This is obviously expected, because people of Sudan, they are against normalizing relationship with Israel. In fact, the government in Sudan, for several countries, several years now, has not been going with what people of Sudan want. And for example, we can only understand the position of the military today mm-hmm. if we understand how they are allied to the Saudi regime and to the Emirati regime, to the UAE regime, and the way they contributed to the war in Yemen, and the war in Yemen is pro-American, pro-Israeli war, actually. So this can only be understood by understanding the complexity in the region and how the Sudanese military is part of this coalition in a way. So they can't, unfortunately, they haven't, they're not following what the people of Sudan want or what the political parties in Sudan want. And this is the reason why they're delaying the election, because they know the result of the election. Unfortunately, in Sudan, usually when when the army takes over the power, they lost. They stay in power. They don't give it to a democratic system. And this has been observed with Omar al-Bashir before, and other presidents in Sudan, unfortunately, because they are acting on the American agenda in the region, which is supporting dictators and supporting people that do not actually represent the people, they don't actually represent the people of Sudan or the people in this region.
Now, Professor Nembra, some analysts believe that President Trump wishes to gain the votes of supporters of the Israeli lobby by brokering this so-called normalization deal. Do you share the same view?
Well, sure, definitely. Remember that the original people who are in support of President Trump in the American elections are the Christian conservatives and mainly the evangelical Christian who are totally in support of Israel and in support of Zionism. And he tried to gain them. They are the base for his voters, the white supremacist and the one who are on the top white people in America. So he wanted to gain the support of those. And these are the also wealthy American who are paying him well for his election campaign and paying also around the different states to ensure the electing Donald Trump for a second term. So definitely the Trump is trying to give them all the indications that he's the only supporter to Israel, in spite of the fact that Democrats historically used to be the main supporter to Israel, but now he's saying that me as a person, Trump, I am the only president in America who dared to move the embassy, who dared to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, mm-hmm. who recognized Golan Heights as part of Israel, who's announcing the or agreeing on the annexation of parts of the West Bank, and is in support of Israel totally, and to normalize the relationship with Israel in the region mm-hmm. With the Arab state. But let me just give you, on the other hand, a small information.
Sure.
A poll was conducted in the Arab world, showed that only 5% in the Arab world, totally, only 5% in support of normalization. Most uh-huh. of the 95% of the Arab people are against normalization. So what we saw in the social media is the electronic flies.
Okay. Now, Ali Al-Faraj, what's behind Washington's push for Arab countries to normalize relations with Israel, even with a crisis in a country like Sudan? I mean, does it serve the upcoming U.S. presidential election, or is there more to it than meets the eye?
It's clear if we have a look at how this is happening in the Middle East, the normalization with the Zionist regime, you see it is done in a way in steps, in a way one country after another, so that once there is a party or something happens with one country, then they wait for a few weeks, then there is another country, and then they wait. So in a way, to keep it in the media all the time, to keep it as the news coming all the time, to serve the American election, to serve President Trump, so that this idea of fake achievement, basically, it will be there in the media all the time. And that indicates clearly that President Trump wants this to be on the news every day, every other week or so, mm-hmm. so that there would be more people in support of him in his election. Usually in the normal circumstances, people do not make deals like this. Countries who are independent, they negotiate, they talk about it for a while, and then they announce what sort of agreements and disagreements, terms, etc., etc., before they sign an agreement, before they agree something,
right.
And they make a deal. For example, while what we have seen, for example, with Bahrain, just as an example, they announced the normalization before even the deal has been done,
right.
before any negotiation has been done, which all indicates that this is all done as an impulsive decision by the American government for the election in the U.S. rather than for the interest of the region.
Okay. Now, I got one last question for both of you gentlemen. What choice or choices are Palestinians left with to defend their cause and free their occupied land now that some Arab countries seemingly are slated to normalize ties with Israel? Professor Nem, go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, in a very short, let me just put it, the Palestinians should change their own mentality regarding the struggle generally. I believe personally that Israel had came to its final episodes. That's why the Trump and others are trying to normalize relations to just give credibility to Israel and more, recognition to Israel. But in reality, no, it's coming to its final episodes, and I believe that the Palestinian Authority and all Palestinian factions, first, they have to reunite under one strategy, which is to fight the whole project. There is no illusion about going back to negotiation with Israel. It should be a decision by all Palestinian factions to choose first their own allies, where to stand, beside whom in the region. And we have the front of resistance, as generally from Iran to Syria, okay. Iraq, Hezbollah, and the Palestinians, and on the other hand, to start the struggle against this Israel in any way we could have in our hands.
Okay, Ali Al-Faraj, please go ahead briefly.
Yeah, obviously, in the now our the position is clear from all the Palestinian leaders. That actually this is not something, an area of dispute, that there is no support for such normalization of any of the Arab or Middle East countries with the Zionist regime. All the political parties in Palestine are against such deals because they are stabbing them in the back, basically. They support without any gain for the Palestinian people. Gaza is still under an embargo. The Palestinian people are still suffering. So there isn't an independent state. Every now and then, Mr. Trump would announce something against the Palestinian people. So there is no benefit. In fact, this is all against the interest of the Palestinian people. It's against the peace in the Middle East.
Because
without the presence of a Palestinian state, how can there be a peace in the Middle East?
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you very much for your comments and insight. Professor of Political Science with Purchase University, Saad Nim, joined us from Ramallah. And political analyst Ali Al-Faraj joined us from Birmingham with their comments and insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The world's largest banks in 2019 provided more than $2.6 trillion in loans and underwriting to economic sectors linked to the global biodiversity crisis, while doing little to monitor, let alone curb, damage to life-sustaining ecosystems. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Bankrolling Extinction. Report shows big banks lent over $2.6 trillion to fund global biodiversity destruction in 2019. Here's the details of this article. The world's largest banks in 2019 provided more than $2.6 trillion in loans and underwriting to economic sectors linked to the global biodiversity crisis, while doing little to monitor, let alone curb, damage to life-sustaining ecosystems. That's according to Bankrolling Extinction, a new report published recently by Portfolio Earth, an initiative seeking to challenge the financial industry's role in ecological devastation. The analysis was described as a frightening statement of the status quo by Dr. Robert Weston, former chair of both UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, that is IPBES, and Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC. Mark Campolone, founder and executive chair of the Carbon Tracker Initiative, said in a statement released recently that this report reminds us that there is no time to lose for governments and financial regulators to create an appropriate rules-based system to oversee and ensure that banks cannot continue to finance this corporate planetary plunder unconstrained and unnoticed. Environmental destruction, the report authors wrote, can no longer be seen as an unfortunate byproduct of economic development. Rather, the COVID-19 pandemic has demonstrated that healthy, biodiverse environments underpin the functioning of our health, societies, and economies. Researchers found that 50 global banks invested more than the entire GDP of Canada in the food, forestry, mining, fossil fuels, infrastructure, tourism, transport, and logistics sectors, activities that IPBES has identified as the major drivers of biodiversity loss. The top 10 offenders were Bank of America, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, Mizuho Financial, Wells Fargo, BNP Paribas, Mitsubishi UFJ Financial, HSBC, MSBC Group, and Barclays. Moreover, the report notes that none of the banks assessed had sufficient systems in place to monitor or measure the impact of their loans on biodiversity loss, nor do they have comprehensive policies to halt it. According to the authors, private financial institutions on Wall Street and elsewhere are unwilling and ill-prepared to promote biodiversity, despite its significance to human life and survival, thanks in part to the fact that the regulators and rules which govern banks currently protect them from any consequences. Instead of heeding scientists' warnings about biological annihilation and its consequences, the financial sector is bankrolling the mass extinction crisis while undermining human rights and indigenous sovereignty. While governments and companies have been the focus of attention on this issue, they continued, actors in the finance sector have largely evaded scrutiny until recently, even though it is their investment decisions that shape the transformation of ecosystems. The report argues that to prevent extinction, banks have to stop funding it. To this end, the researchers call for banks to disclose and radically reduce their impact on nature and stop finance for new fossil fuels, deforestation, overfishing, and ecosystem destruction. Governments to stop protecting the role of banks in biodiversity destruction and rewrite the rules of finance to hold banks liable for the damage caused by their lending, and people everywhere to have a say in how their money is invested, and a right to stop banks from causing serious harm to people and planet. Moira Berth, climate and finance director of Amazon Watch, said that if the Amazon rainforest is going to survive, and if we are to have a future on this planet, financial institutions must stop funneling trillions of dollars into the very industries unabashedly driving biodiversity loss. By maintaining a global system fundamentally based on eternal economic growth and never-ending exploitation of natural elements, said Hannah Begovic of Earth Advocacy Youth, we allow for life on Earth to be considered human-owned property whose point of existence is to be exploited and commodified for human benefit and economic profit. Kai Chan, a professor at the University of British Columbia and a leading author of the IPBES Global Assessment Report, noted that a global sustainable economy sits at the center of the humanity's much-needed transformation to meet the climate and ecological crises. And at the center of that, Chan added, sit the banks and the finance institutions whose investments power development around the globe. According to Todd Poglia, executive director at Stand.Earth, today's visionary financial institutions are those that invest in projects that regenerate our oceans, forests, and climate. We need to reverse the damage of several centuries of banks investing in the destruction of the heart, lungs, and limbs of our planet, he added, and do so in short order. Robin Smale, director of Vivid Economics, pointed out that the current legal system protects banks from responsibility and liability and therefore reduces their business incentive to help address damaging activities. Smale argued that removing these legal protections would force banks to more systematically address the biodiversity impacts of their financing and transform activities across major supply chains. Imagine a world, said Chan, in which projects can only raise capital when they have demonstrated that they will contribute meaningfully and positively to restoring the planet's bounty and a safe climate for all. That's the future this report envisions and builds toward, he concluded.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.